Blog Talk Radio.
Companions. It's a pleasure to have you here on the, what are we looking at, the 23rd day of November. It's only the 327th day of the year. So that leaves us with plenty, 37 days left in this year. It's done, finished, over, move on. Next, the exciting part is there's only 28 days until the winter solstice. 28 days until the first day of winter. So that's, I think, putting us in good perspective. I'm glad to see that there's so many of you enjoying and taking little bits of information and away from their program, and I hope that you I find it useful. I've started a chat room that I'll try and juggle with the program. It's stunning trying to read and talk, read the comments of listeners, and continue on the script. It's just stunning. So you hear these uncomfortable and pauses, and I feel like I always feel like laughing. I should be trying to think and walk and chew gum at the same time. Just not going to happen. But it's a good day to be a Mason. Good day for the impact of principles and philosophy of masonry on the world. But in order to do that, people like you and I need to be good students of the craft. At least it deserves that. I want to talk to you today. This program, as you know, was referred to as the Masonic Secret. No, not John Morgan. I don't think I'm going to be floated across the Niagara by our American brethren to see if they can get snuff out this declaration. I'm talking not so much about the politics and the mystery, but I'm talking about a deeper truth of Freemasonry that I think is some of the secrets. And it's like what happens, the secret about what happens when we get together as a group. As a large group, I don't mean the pettiness and silliness of, peaks and quarrels, shish stuff, the ruthless Lilliputian armies running around deciding whether you're open your egg by the big end or the little end. Well, that's enough to go to war. And if it's not any more profound than that, we should probably put our sabers and crossbows on the shelf and sit down and get busy with the issues of life. Aren't you at least a bit curious about the secrets? Of course you are. But the interesting part of masonry you discover is the amount of opinion pieces that are written. I thought that for whatever reason, when I sat down to study of Freemasonry, I thought that there would be a definitive canon. Here is the way it is or was. And then I found you really are wading through the weeds. You're looking for validation of information because there's so many different departments, if you will. There's the mythology, there's the and superstition, there's the occult, that metaphysical component, and then there's the practical fact-based historical. And then there's the revisionist made-up myths, the revisionist history. And as we know from last week, it had its start back in the competition for legitimacy when the first Constitution was drafted, don't we? Anderson, is it valid? Do you subscribe to the authenticity of the article that references? I would think if you can find a more authentic source, then you're going to be going very, very far, because this one seemed to be the most fact-based that I've ever heard, and it declared that. In fact, James Anderson made up a lot of things. And did we take them seriously? Well, good fellows like you and me would come along, pick up what he had made up and say, well, this, you know, James is a good man and he has a good pedigree. It must be valid. Who knows what was going through his mind at the time he wrote it? Who knows what his intention was? But we do know that it's likely he was trying to encourage membership and participation. That refrain happens continuously. That, I think, is one of the landmarks of Freemasonry. I'm about to rewrite the landmarks. You can have yours, but I want my own. I want to have my own landmarks. And part of it is the landmarks of Freemasonry, as I open my eyes wide and look around at what's truth. Truth is, we have a lot of information in front of us, and in fact, we don't have a tour guide through the laboratories and libraries. Wish we did. You've heard me talk about, with some people, I'm not the bee's knees by any means, but I like to put together an index, share at least the ideas and materials that I've discovered with people that are curious to see if they, you know, they validate it. The more we repeat the experiment and get a consistent result, the more we validate. Now, is that to say that the experiment is bang on and perfect? Well, no. No, not necessarily. It's more along the lines of saying, you know, we have something to say, and that we've found something. The model might be need to be changed. Remember, as we go through life, we make new observations. We have new tools that help us make very fine observations, and as we accumulate knowledge and facts, it allows us to refine history, not to revise it for some agenda, but to accurately describe what it was that's gone on in the past. Unvarnished, of course. You're a bit curious, I hope, about the secrets. A fraternity 300 years and going. No frat party. No adolescent male testosterone-driven embarrassment to ourselves. Philanthropic, authentic, dignified. Striving with piety. Accepting the equality and liberty of humanity, the mystery, the secrets, the signs of greetings known to the few, the real thing. Ever wonder why we do it? What a man finds in Masonry that he can't find elsewhere. It isn't fortune. It isn't power. None of that. It's a feeling. The one you get when you find when truth finds you. Not smarter, not smug, not gain or advantage. When you see what others do not, in a world so frightened and mistrustful, truths are a weighty responsibility. It's the power of humility, not pride and not arrogance. Knowledge is truth. But is that all? There are more truths, but that's all I'm going to say. There's more to say about this. Masonic secret. It's that feeling. When you get it, when you understand. Amazing. Amazing. I don't know how it can only prepare you. Masonry is one way, but there are others. Make no mistake. Make no mistake. It's like that, the light going on where things start to come together based on fact, based on an understanding of information. So push aside the emotionally based thinking that causes ruin around the world. The Mason in us tells us it's important to gain control of our emotion. Was it Epictetus? Help me here. Was it Epictetus who said it's easier to forgive an enemy than to forgive a friend when you're wronged? Man. Natural law is really tough, isn't it? Really is tough. It's unrelenting. It doesn't give much quarter. A little few things that you know. We'll get on with the Christopher Wren. We were talking about him. Yeah. Did you know, here's a little thing. Work this into your dinner conversation. Between 1901 and 1960, every independent country had a coup d'etat except Sweden, Switzerland, the UK, and the US. I gather they would put us as part of the UK, wouldn't they? Yeah. Here in Canada. Did you know that the Las Vegas Strip is the most visited tourist destination in the world? Followed by Times Square. If you're thinking about Britain, the top tourist draw in Britain is number 40, and that's the British Museum. Interesting here about influence, though. You know, the College Sandhurst, you know, princes and kings. Four reigning Arab monarchs are graduates of Sandhurst. King Abdullah of Jordan, King Hamad of Bahrain, Sheikh Tamim, Emir of Qatar, and Sultan Qaboos of Oman. Yeah. Who knew? Who knew? And just in case you're needing a new word to inject into your vocabulary, try this. Schnapsody. Schnapsody. It's a German word for an ingenious plan that one hatches while drunk. Schnapsody. Let's tuck into a little bit of work here and get busy. As only we can. A little bit about changes that are going on. Always change. Always needing to be observant. The discussion is that I would be better at this if I knew your opinions. Your opinions are enormously valid and important, and they help refine what it is. It help refine understanding. So in the beginning of the 19th century, thanks to Anderson and Preston, there was a general acceptance that Christopher Wren was not only a member of the craft, but had been the head of it. The question we must now ask is when and why did this change? How did we get to the stage of doubting Wren was a member at all? I guess it's like this: the author of this is like saying to us, in order to really grasp your subject, to really clearly understand it at an intellectual level, you need to be able to take up the argument or the point from the idea, from the mind of the enemy. And when you can understand the mind of the enemy, then you will have a clear understanding of the issues at hand between you, between the parties. Until then, we run around chasing our tails. So try to keep that in mind. But it's like not accepting the mind of the enemy. It's understanding. Ah, isn't truly that a reminder about seeking the light? By the beginning of the 19th century, Preston and Anderson had done their business, convinced us that Christopher Wren was one of the craft. But now we're wondering, how did it come about? If that was a given fact, if that salesmanship had worked, when did the suspicion, when did doubt start to creep into it? As we have seen, the histories compiled in the 18th century were not based on reliable evidence. Mm-hmm. They were riddled with historical errors and copied each other without reflection. That's really a risk when we copy something that is wrong. And my goodness, we find through history, our historians teach us that quite regularly. Always the juicy little gossipy things. We'll talk about the juicy, gossipy life of Albert Pike one day. Throughout most of the 19th century, there was a growing interest in medieval history, but Masonic history remained very much an amateur pursuit, mired in myths and speculation. What do the masses of amateurs like best but to salivate over mystery and speculation? The study of non-Masonic history at the time was often little better than that, but that was changing. There was a growing discussion of the importance and nature of historical evidence and the need to return to original sources. This is the 19th century. So we've had, it started off in the 18th century, where the Declaration of Governance and constitutional Freemasonry, by 100 years in, it was laden with stories of superstition and myth. And yet, when you looked across the room or had a discussion with a serious-minded man, my goodness, it's embarrassing to think that we dedicate ourselves to, or can be taken seriously or take seriously, a subject that's based solely on myth. Haven't we intellectually progressed beyond that? Well, of course we had. There was a growing discussion of the importance and nature of evidence and the return to the original sources. So that's where we see, as a body, the search began. The publication in 1840 of the Regius manuscript, remember that was the one that was buried in the vaults of the monarch of the day, the earliest text of the old charges, remember who found that? And the subsequent discovery of many other versions led to a realization that Anderson's account was little more than a fairy story. There was a call among Freemasons for the formulation of a new and truly accurate account of the history of Masonry. In the 1870s, a group of Masons who would later be described as the Authentic School decided to do just that. They organized themselves into a new college, which they called Quattro Coronate. Its aim was specifically to promote accurate Masonic scholarship, taking nothing on trust that could not be proved by historical evidence. One of the nine founders, Robert Frake Gould, turned his attention to Anderson's history and set about demolishing it. In the process, he created much of the confusion we have today over whether Wren was a Mason. And it is thus necessary to look quite hard at his analysis to understand the problems involved. Now, Robert Frake Gould was born in 1836. I'm not really sure, I think. But he lived well into the 20th century, died in 1915. And he was born near Minehead in Somerset. And he was the son of a local churchman. and his early life was spent in the army. He became a Freemason in 1855. A little noteworthy for Canadian, the Grand Lodge of Canada. And he was initiated at Royal Navy Lodge. And there was numbered 429 then, now numbered 621 for those who like that trivia. He was subsequently stationed in Malta and India and China. And in 1864, he left the army and returned to study law at the Inner Temple, being called to the bar on 6th of June, 1868. But he practiced law and lived in Russell Square, and it was during this period he began his Masonic researches in the library at Great Queen Street. Gould was scathing of contemporary Masonic scholarship, writing that the cardinal defect of the great majority of Masonic writers, which made the literature of Freemasonry a byword and reproach, was the presentation of statements fully destitute of ordinary proof. He set out to correct this state of affairs in his History of Masonry, which was published between 1883 and 1887, and it ran to 3 volumes. He devoted much of the second volume to demolishing Anderson's history, no fewer than 52 pages on the subject of Wren's place in Freemasonry. It is Gould's account that is often taken as the authoritative treatment of the subject, even though it is now over 100 years old. Gould's attack on Wren was principally based on his wish to show that Anderson's account was completely unreliable. I've already shown that Anderson's account was highly inaccurate, but in his time it was still accepted as fact. It was Gould who was the first to attack it in writing. He actually took it a step further, maintaining that everything in Anderson's account was entirely inaccurate. To do so, he attacked the facts that Anderson used. The reason his attack was so convincing was the sheer quantity of reading he had brought to bear on the subject. On each point, he made thorough searches of all the literature and returned to the original sources. Much of Gould's attack holds true, but, and this is vitally important to the current topic, not all of it. While Gould was correct that Anderson's account was almost entirely a fabrication, and that a great many of the facts in it can be shown to be incorrect and clearly made up, it does not follow, as Gould was often too quick to assume, that Anderson was necessarily wrong on everything he said. Occasionally, he may have been correct. Thus, while Anderson maintained many major historical figures were Freemasons, and Gould is correct that his testimony in this regard cannot be used as evidence, it does not mean that they were not Masons. But with Wren in particular, Gould was keen to show that this was the case. When it came to Wren, Gould did not limit himself to Anderson's accounts. He looked at the whole range of materials that had come to light since. He was meticulous in his research and only missed things out because they were not available in the library of Great Queen Street at the time. Unfortunately, as he searched, he unearthed more and more evidence pointing to Wren being a Mason. And so in each case, in order to undermine Anderson, he had to find faults with each. Not all of his analysis stands scrutiny. The evidence he examined can be divided into 4 categories. Obituaries, parentalia, Manningheim's letter, and John Aubrey's account. First, the obituaries. The first places Gould searched were the obituaries, and the earliest obituary of Wren was published the week he died in the Postboy, February 1723. It made no mention of Freemasonry, but the following week the notice of the funeral did. London, March 5th. This evening, the corpse of that worthy Freemason, Sir Christopher Wren, Knight, is to be interred in the Church of St. Paul's. Gould was also noted that a similar notice appeared in the British Journal on the 9th of March. who maintained that this was copied from the postboy. This created an embarrassment for Gould, but he dismissed it on the principle that the postboy was advertising the first edition of Anderson's Constitutions, and that thus he maintained the editors were merely using Wren's death as an advertisement. Nonetheless, the obituaries remain strange, and Gould's explanation is not entirely convincing. The second is the parentalia. The second piece of evidence that Gould needed to tackle was that included in Wren's biography, Parentalia, which had been compiled by his son, confusingly also called Christopher Wren, and published by his grandson in 1750. Preston had used Parentalia as a source for many of his facts on Wren's life and work. In tackling this, Gould was on firmer ground because Freemasons are barely mentioned, and Wren's involvement never suggested. In his History of Architecture, the work mentions bands of traveling Masons and Freemasonry specifically, but this may have been inserted by his son. The section does not claim to be a quotation from Wren. The only place in Parentalia that anything approaching a hint of Wren being a Mason appears is in the description of the placing of the last stone on the lantern, which is described as being carried out by other free and accepted Masons. However, Wren's son was a Mason, and if he was wishing to insinuate that his father was one, he could have been much clearer. Further confusion has since been caused by the insertion of Wren's grandson of an 18th century Masonic engraving in his personal copy of the printed Parentalia, the so-called heirloom copy, stored at the Royal Institute of British Architects and reprinted by Gregg Press in 1965. Careless scholarship has led some commentators to suggest that this print was in Parentalia, but it was not. It is a later insertion in one manuscript copy and is not replicated in the printed version. Printed Parentalia does contain Wren's description of King Solomon's temple, but this is not particularly Masonic. In particular, it makes no mention of Hiram Abiff, the legendary Masonic figure who plays such a crucial role in Masonic ritual. But this should not surprise us. Hiram Abiff does not seem to have appeared in Masonic ritual until after 1717, when the ritual was elaborated. And so Hiram would not have been known to Wren, even if he had been a Mason. It does, however, give us a stark reminder that Freemasonry in the late 17th century was much simpler than Freemasonry today. The third piece of evidence was a letter dated the 12th of July, 1757, from Thomas Manningham, former Deputy Grand Master between 1752 and 56, of the Premier Grand Lodge of England, in reply to inquiries regarding the authenticity of certain degrees which had recently appeared in Holland. The letter was published in 1868 and cited as evidence for Wren's membership. It runs, "These innovations are of very late years, and I believe the brethren will find difficulty to produce a Mason acquainted with any such form 10 years. My own father has been a Mason these 50 years and has been in lodges in Holland, France, and England. He knows none of these ceremonies. Grandmaster Payne, who succeeded Sir Christopher Wren, is a stranger to them, as is likewise one old brother of 90 who I conversed with lately." The brother, note he means here the 90-year-old, not Wren, assured me that he was made a Mason in his youth and had constantly frequented lodges till rendered incapable by his advanced age. As Gould rightly points out, this letter is only stating that Payne was one of the Grand Masters who succeeded Wren. There is no suggestion Manningham knew Wren personally, and as Gould says, he was merely repeating the myth laid down in Anderson. Thus, the Manningham letter, like Parentalia, helps us little in searching for evidence of Wren's membership of the craft and was easily dismissed. And the last Aubrey's account. Gould found it much more difficult to dismiss the last piece of evidence. The account by Wren's contemporary, John Aubrey, 1626 to 1697. John Aubrey was a gentleman antiquarian, and he was born in Easton Pierce in West Wiltshire, the eldest son of a long-established family of Welsh descent. He was educated at Trinity College, Oxford, and the Middle Temple. In the 1650s, he was active among the close circle of scientists surrounding Wilkins. He knew Hooke and Wren well. By the time Aubrey inherited his father's estates in 1652, they consisted of nothing more than substantial debts. He lost everything settling these. The second half of his life was spent begging accommodation from friends and trying to avoid a debtor's prison. He lived a peripatetic existence, always traveling, always researching. After his death, he left behind large numbers of manuscripts, but he lacked the discipline to finish pieces for publication. Aubrey's account of Wren's involvement in masonry was hidden in not one but two of these unpublished manuscripts, one in the Bodleian Library and the other in the archives of the Royal Society. There they had remained unnoticed for over 150 years before they were rediscovered and printed by Halliwell in the notes to the second edition of his Masonic poem in 1844. The whole book from which they were taken, A Natural History of Wiltshire, was finally printed for the first time in 1847. Aubrey's assertion is clear and unambiguous, dated 1691. Madam, this day, May the 18th, being after Rogation Sunday, Monday, is a great convention at St. Paul's Church of the Fraternity of the Free Accepted Masons, where Sir Christopher Wren is to be adopted a brother, and Sir Henry Goodrick of the Tower, and divers others. There have been kings that have been of this Saul Delight. Clearly, those writers who say there is no evidence of Wren's membership of the craft are mistaken. This is clearly, certainly evidence. Why then do other writers still say that the case is unproven? The reason is that Aubrey's evidence was so vehemently dismissed by Gould. As we examine Gould's dismissal, we see that it is further hasty and based on incomplete information. It was based on an overwhelming desire to prove Anderson incorrect without due regard for the facts. Curiously, Gould does not seem to realize that he could accept Aubrey's account without damaging his argument against Anderson because, of course, if Aubrey's account is correct, then Anderson's whole story about Wren being a grand officer as early as 1666 is clearly a fabrication. However, Gould seems to have ignored the possibility and in his haste to destroy Anderson's credibility on every point attempted to prove that Aubrey's evidence too was false. And here Gould used three lines of attack to undermine Aubrey's statement. That Aubrey was a credulous individual whose evidence could not be trusted, that the fellows of the Royal Society at the time must have read Aubrey's account but failed to note it, that if something had happened to the lodge in 1691, it would have been recorded elsewhere. Thankfully, new evidence has appeared since Gould's time, and we can now tackle all these objections. Wren and Freemasonry in the 21st century. Returning to the sources. Before re-examining Gould's claim that Aubrey's account is unreliable, it is worth noting briefly that what professional historians mean by historical evidence. In looking for historical evidence, we are looking for contemporary documentation of an event. We are first concerned that the document itself can be shown to be genuine. We are then concerned that the person writing the account is not lying. It is thus important that they have no motive for doing so or for twisting their account to suit their own ends. We are also looking for their closeness to the people involved and the event in question. Ideally, of course, they should be eyewitness to the event, but in practice, this is often not the case. So we have to satisfy ourselves that the person in question has access to reliable sources. Lastly, we would look to see reactions of any contemporaries who had access to the document and whether they considered it accurate or not. Let us now turn these professional tools on Aubrey's account. First, are the documents genuine? Luckily, both copies survive and can be examined. The original is in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and the copy is in the archives of the Royal Society. Contemporary scholarship has confirmed that the Bodleian copy is entirely in Aubrey's own hand, as are the amendments. It is thus genuine. The Royal Society copy is contemporary with the Bodleian one. Professor Michael Hunter, a leading authority on the Royal Society, has attested to its authenticity. He has pointed out that it is in the hand of Mr. B.G. Kramer, the clerk of the Society between 1690 and mid-1691, and that the records show he was paid £7 to make the copy. He also notes that Aubrey had been given the opportunity to amend and update his original manuscript and had instructed Kramer accordingly. Aubrey must have gone back to his 1685 manuscript in the Ashmolean Museum in 1690-91 and made the new additions to that before Kramer copied it. It thus seems likely that Kramer's version was actually done after the event recorded, that is, after Wren had been adopted. Bernard Williamson and Michael Bagent have pointed out that Wren was still active in the Royal Society at the time, and it is difficult to believe that the entry was put in without his consent or knowledge, or that it would have been corrected by Kramer during the copying process had the event not taken place. It is also worth noting that Aubrey's manuscript is of a book, his Natural History of Wiltshire. The book is littered with remarks and contributions from Wren, a fact that Gould conveniently chose to ignore. As we know, Aubrey knew Wren at college, and he had obviously consulted him extensively during the compilation of his text. This is particularly important when it comes to the next point, Aubrey's reliability. In the 19th century, John Aubrey had acquired a reputation for unreliability. This was based partly on his interest in hermetism and partly on an unfortunate incident that arose in Oxford. Aubrey had been helping Anthony Wood to compile biographies of Oxford alumni. Wood was prosecuted by the first Earl of Clarendon for libel, and Aubrey was cited in court as one of the sources of the false information. As a result, for much of the 18th and 19th centuries, Aubrey's reputation was tainted, and in claiming Aubrey was unreliable, Gould was just reflecting the opinion of the time. 20th century scholarship restored Aubrey's reputation as a useful historical reference. Professor Michael Hunter pointed out in his 1975 biography of Aubrey the extraordinary honor the Royal Society had accorded him in asking for his copy of the manuscript book on Wiltshire. As he says, it cost them a considerable sum of money, £7, hardly an honor that would have extended to somebody they considered an unreliable charlatan. Moreover, as we have seen, many of the facts in the texts in question were supplied by Wren, supporting the fact that they were in close contact over its contents. What of Gould's claims that no one at the time seems to have mentioned Aubrey's account of Wren's membership? This, too, can now be dismissed thanks to the discovery of a manuscript copy of Aubrey's statement in one of John Evelyn's copybooks in the British Library. The wording is exactly Aubrey's, and clearly Evelyn came across the passage and thought it worthy of copying out. Evelyn knew Wren, and he is thus a clear example of exactly what Gould claimed was missing, a person who knew Wren, accepting the account and repeating it without comment or refutation. Admittedly, this is negative evidence. Evelyn did not assert it was false, but equally he did not confirm its veracity. What then is the last claim? That if such an important event happened in 1691, why is there no mention of it elsewhere? So few dates of Masonic events are known in the 17th century that it would be surprising if it had been. However, it turns out that the date 1691 is clearly mentioned as being important in two published sources. The first is in Samuel Pritchard's Masonry Dissected. He says the terms of free and accepted masonry, as it is now, has not been heard of till those within those few years. No constituted lodges or quarterly communications were heard of until 1691. Then lords and dukes, lawyers and shopkeepers, and other inferior tradesmen, porters not accepted, were admitted into the mystery or no mystery. And the second is in Pine's list of regular lodges according to their seniority of 1729, which states that Lodge Number 1 met at St. Paul's Churchyard and was constituted in 1691. This suggests that the Great Assembly was to do with the formation or reformation of Lodge Number 1, which is now Lodge of Antiquity Number 2. It also suggests that this is the lodge that Wren joined. Aubrey's evidence, I would argue, as reliable as any other 17th century account we have. Aubrey has no reason to lie. He is an independent source and he was recording events at the time. It might be argued that he was writing about something yet to happen, but we know that the piece was transcribed into the second copy after the fact, without correction by somebody who could have checked. This, then, is a good evidence, as we have for 17th century Mason, in a period for which no lodge lists survive. Elias Ashmole, for example, is generally accepted as being a Mason, but the only proof we have of his membership is his own diaries, hardly an independent source. Many more Masons identified in this period are only known to be Masons because Ashmole says they were. Aubrey is independent of Wren. He had no reason to lie. I would argue Aubrey's account is as reliable as Ashmole's. If this is the case and we are willing to accept others on Ashmole's evidence as Masons, we should accept that Wren was too. It is true that the evidence is not bulletproof, but it is as good as it gets before lodge records exist. This brings us to the penultimate point. If Wren was a Mason, which lodge did he join in 1691? Was it the one at St. Paul's? Miraculously, the old lodge near St. Paul's, which met at the Goose and Gridiron listed in Pine as having its first meeting in 1691, is still in existence, renamed and renumbered. It's now called the Lodge of Antiquity Number 2. The relationship between the Lodge of Antiquity and Wren is one of tradition, but it is a tradition that goes back to the middle of the 18th century. There are no surviving minutes of the meeting when Wren joined the lodge and no lists that include his name. This has led some writers to dismiss his membership of the Lodge of Antiquity as a piece of wishful thinking on the part of its members in general and William Preston in particular. The situation is clearly complicated by the fact that Preston is responsible for the events that led to the loss of its earliest records. William Preston joined the Lodge of Antiquity on the 15th of June, 1774. In the following years, he was highly successful in recruiting new members. What had been a moribund lodge quickly grew in strength. Nevertheless, in the process, he upset a number of the older members of the lodge, not least because he introduced his new system of lectures into the lodge, which no doubt dominated the proceedings. 3 years later, on the 27th of December, 1777, Preston unwisely gave his enemies an opportunity to move against him. He and a number of other members of the lodge attended a special service held for them at St. Dunstan's, across the road from the Mitre Tavern, where the lodge met at the time. After the service, they unwisely returned to the tavern, still dressed in their Masonic regalia. Preston was duly reported to Grand Lodge for unauthorized wearing of regalia in public and expelled from the craft. Preston had considerable support from within the lodge, and instead of going quietly, he decided to split the lodge in two, bringing many of its members with him. For a period of 12 years, between 1778 and 1790, there were two lodges of antiquity, one still working under the Premier Grand Lodge, and the other under Preston's influence working under the Grand Lodge of York. Preston even went as far as stealing the possessions of the lodge from the tavern. Eventually, the two lodges were reconciled, and Preston was allowed back into the Premier Grand Lodge. But when the possessions were returned, the earliest minute books covering the period 1721 to 1734 were missing. Preston was immensely proud of his membership of the Lodge of Antiquity, and many historians have accused him of fabricating the story that Wren was a member. But the records that the lodge still retain are quite clear that the tradition predates Preston's membership. The evidence for a long tradition is irrefutable. Firstly, various artifacts are mentioned in the records with reference to having belonged to Wren and that he was a member. Secondly, some of the surviving records give historical details which corroborate this. And thirdly, an independent source exists in the form of a reference to an early printed book. The reference in the book to Wren's membership of the Lodge of Antiquity is the most recent discovery. It appears in the preface of Alexander Slade's The Freemason Examined, which is published in London in 1754. He says, "My father was made a Freemason about the year 1708 when Sir Christopher Wren was Grand Master at the oldest lodge in London, then held at the Goose and Gridiron Alehouse. At that time many persons of distinction were admitted, and he, being known to understand Masonry well, was often been sent for by noblemen and other eminent persons to instruct them in the art. While the facts of this statement cannot be verified, they show that the Lodge of Antiquity and Wren were already linked in 1754, long before Preston's involvement, and within living memory of Wren's death. Such a link is not mentioned in Anderson's mythological history. It is independent of it. The association of Wren and the Lodge of Antiquity thus predated Preston's arrival. As proof of Wren's membership, the lodge retained five artifacts, namely a mall, a set of three candlesticks, and a portrait. All of these survive. The mall may or may not have belonged to Wren. The plaque it now bears claims that it was used by Charles I to lay the foundation stone of St. Paul's. However, the plaque was added in 1827. One of the Lodge of Antiquities manuscript record books, Book E, which was written much later in 18th century hand, not Preston's, carries a minute which might have been copied from one of the lost minute books. Queen's Arm, March 18, 1722, Brother Lowfield, Master. Several vestiges of old time were laid before the lodge, particularly the old mallet used at the laying of foundation stone of St. Paul's Cathedral. Some curious writings were also produced. Brother de Saulier being present, the writings were delivered over to him, and the mallet ordered to be preserved in the lodge as a curiosity, together with a curious manuscript roll written in the reign of James II containing the ancient charges. On page 125 of the book E, the mall is certainly old and is now kept on display in the Museum of Great Queen Street. The candlesticks were still used in the lodge and stand beside the master's and warden's chair. They are wooden, about 3 feet tall and gilded and have plaques reading Ex Dono Charles Wren, Christopher Wren, Esquire, AL 5680, implying that they were donated in 1680. That date is to be treated with skepticism, as the plaque appears to be later additions. The late 18th century account in Book E states, Queen's Arm, June 3rd, 1723. Probably 1722, as entries on either side for that date. Brother Strong, Master. The work of masonry was carried on with proper spirit and the brethren joined in harmony. The three mahogany candlesticks presented to the lodge by the worthy old master, Sir Christopher Wren, ordered to be carefully deposited in a wooden case lined with cloth to be immediately purchased for the purpose. Both the candlesticks and the mallet were certainly in the possession of the lodge in 1778 because they were among the items listed by Brother Norick as having been stolen by Preston and his associates when they formed a breakaway lodge. Both thus established an 18th century tradition of Wren's membership. Sadly, the portrait is the one item that we can say with absolute certainty has nothing at all to do with Wren. It is also the one artifact that we can attribute with confidence to Preston. It was purchased under his mastership of the Breakaway Lodge, and the minutes of March 12, 1788 record this. Brother Wren then informed the lodge that he had fortunately met with a portrait of Sir Christopher Wren, formerly the master of this lodge, drawn by Sir Godfrey Kneller, which might be purchased for 10 guineas, and that as he considered it would be a great ornament to this lodge, he should propose that subscription should be open for that purpose. And to show his attachment to this lodge on the occasion, he would open the subscription with 5 guineas. I am afraid to say Brother Bradley was conned. The portrait has hung for many years in Freemasons Hall, proudly displaying the plaque reading Sir Christopher Wren, Grandmaster, 1685. Worshipful Master of Ye Old St. Paul's, now the Lodge of Antiquity, formerly number one, now number two. But if we compare it with known portraits of Wren, it is clearly nothing like him. For the last 30 years, architectural historians have identified this portrait as being the earliest surviving picture of another 18th century architect of note, William Talman. The Lodge of Antiquity has been rather slow in updating the plaque. By way of proof, look at the portrait of Talman at an old age with his family in the National Portrait Gallery. The likeness of the sitter in the Lodge of Antiquity portrait with Talman's son is striking, suggesting that the portrait is the elder Talman in his youth. The artifacts of the Lodge of Antiquity's possessions may or may not have belonged to Wren. The important thing to note is that by the end of the 18th century, the Lodge of Antiquity had already owned most of them for a long time and clearly believed they did. Moreover, the missing record books presumably supported rather than refuted this assertion. It seems likely that Wren was indeed a member of the Lodge of Antiquity. So, in summary, I'm sure, if nothing else, I've managed to show why there is so much confusion surrounding Wren's membership of Freemasonry. The situation is undoubtedly complicated, but I have hope I have also shown that there is convincing evidence that for Wren being a Mason. When looking for historical evidence of membership, we are looking for an independent account from an uninterested party who knew Wren well. On all these accounts, Aubrey's description fits the bill. Evelyn's account, the obituaries, the Slade account, and all the other bits of evidence back this up. From Aubrey, it seems to me that we have clear evidence that Wren was a Mason and that he joined a lodge in May 1691. I think we can now safely campaign for the Grand Lodge website to be amended accordingly to include his name among the great Freemasons. We can certainly stop saying there is no evidence that Wren was a Mason. Beyond that, I think we need to exercise extreme care. I hope it has been shown to be very likely that the lodge he joined was associated with St. Paul's Cathedral, which met at the Goose and Gridiron, in St. Paul's Churchyard, which was probably at the time had a number of craftsmen working on the cathedral as members. There are plenty of suggestions that this was the case, but you cannot say with any certainty that he was a member, or that he was a regular attendee or a keen mason, or that he can say that he was ever master of his lodge, although he might have been. The accounts of his contemporaries suggest that many people may have attended their lodge once to be initiated, and that was it. But we know so little of masonry in this period, it is impossible to say anything with that certainty. Anything else is pure speculation. There is no independent or reliable evidence that Wren was ever any kind of Grand Master or that his membership in any way predated 1691. There. And if you've been to St. Paul's, you know that it sits on the top of what was a little hill and that the stonework continues out the side door and you into different old buildings and shops, the tavern. So you know that this would have been on the property, of the property, but not within St. Paul's. Anyway, have we convinced you of something useful in the discussion of Sir Christopher Wren and put to rest the notion that anything worthwhile or valid is amateur? Amateur is just that. I go to an amateur recital to listen to my daughter doing a Christmas play. But it's not... it's not the Winter Theater, it's not Stratford, it is what it is. It's not the Opera House, no, it is what it is. Can it be appreciated? Of course. But don't mistake one for the other. Anderson may not have realized, given his cleverness and position, that this would have been found out, that his ruse would have been found out at some later time. But it has. Are we any the better off? I would certainly say so. We have now an endorsement of a process of investigation to find verifiable and objective facts. Anderson had an agenda to create that first constitution, to create a provenance that would give authenticity, aimed at increasing participation, interest, and curiosity. And I would hope he was successful, but we were misled. We were misled. Be gentle to ourselves in that thinking. Being that this is the work of a professional historian and a brother, member of the craft, we now know the tools that we have at our fingertips are exactly the kind of thing that our ancient brethren would have wished for in their wildest dreams. To be able to have the resources to investigate and verify and to have people that dedicated to move to question, always to question. How many times do we find that when we blindly believe that we are being played? Not to be the skeptic, but to be always questioning in our minds, searching for validity. I think this has served more than a useful purpose, because the scheme of this today was about Masonic mystery. The feeling that, remember, the feeling that is achieved when you get it, when you've struggled for something, You've searched for something and it's found. Does that change or alter the world around us? Only if you know how to use that tool. So, in 31 days and 14 hours and 59 minutes, it'll be Christmas. Let's prepare for it in our hearts and in our minds. Whether we're with a crowd or whether we're alone, whether we have friends around us, we have memories. It is a matter of choice what you do with that information. The memories were real. The facts were part of your history. The joy of Christmas comes from within, not ever from without. Can you find the inspiration? That's your task. If you don't give yourself a full opportunity, if you're not persistent, you may never find it. Don't ever pretend that because you can't find it, it doesn't exist and it's not there. Don't ever pretend that what you see around you that isn't the truth of Christmas, the spirit of Christmas, is invalid. It has nothing to do with what you're able to achieve inside yourself. These are the advances, the gains of Masonic thought. Be reflective. Aude, vide, tace. I hope Masonic Companion has been useful today, and I look forward to seeing you again on the 30th of November. Remember, this is day 327. We have, I can't tell you the phase of the moon. Here we go. You'd think I would know better. But I am governed by, I exchanged long ago the rule of the lunar calendar with measurement of time that I can wear on my wrist. Thank goodness. I love science. Even though I can't tell what it is that we're measuring, I love the fact that we can measure it with precision. And now for some music. Thank you for being part of the crowd. Thank you for supporting Masonic Home Companion. I look forward to sitting in lodge with each and every one of you. This is from the 13th and 14th century. A little bit of toe-tapping from the 14th century. Bye. 13th, 14th century love song. Tap your toe to this. See you later.
I don't know about the coin.
Sunday morning, Zydeco.
That was real Zydeco. Zydeco.